Welcome to episode 257 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me is Don Winslow to talk about City in Ruins, the third installment of his crime fiction trilogy of Danny Ryan, a character we first met as a young man on the Rhode Island shore, soon to be on the run from both the mob and the law, and who, in City in Ruins, the book we're going to talk about today, has transcended many, but by no means all, of his personal and professional challenges. To quote from the Inside Dust Jacket, "Sometimes you have to become what you hate to protect what you love," to which I would add, "and who you love." Welcome, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We've known each other a few years. We've talked about a few books.
Yeah, we have.
And I've talked to a lot of other writers, and I've certainly read my share of crime fiction. And your crime fiction is almost impossible to categorize, which I think is a very, very good thing. But at the same time, your fiction brings a tremendous amount to the reader's table. And the stories, City in Ruins in particular, but the entire trilogy and your entire oeuvre are epic, as in they follow the course of your admittedly flawed hero, Danny Ryan, through trials that would be at home in Greek mythology. And I think it's fitting that the epigraphs for each section are quotes from Virgil's Aeneid. And on top of that, you have a positively Victor Hugo-esque Inspector Jarvis figure in FBI Reggie Mineta. So
yeah,
that's a couple of things to talk about there.
All right. Okay. Let's talk about it.
How much did the idea of this journey and seeking influence, not just City in Ruins, but the entire three books?
No, all of it. Well, 30 years ago now, I read the Iliad for the first time, believe it or not. And I was so struck by the similarities to crime fiction, but also crime history, the history that I grew up around in New England. And so the task I set myself was to write a crime epic that could stand alone as a modern crime novel with no reference to the classics at all, and yet still track and honor those characters and stories and themes from the Greeks and the Romans.
And of course, with a little bit of Victor Hugo, because Danny is a bit of a Jean Valjean. And when I first met Reggie Mineta, I thought, this woman is channeling Inspector Jarvis.
Well, I didn't think of that particularly, but you know, if you say so, that's, you know, listen, I always believe that the reader's perception is correct. You know, whatever the reader takes away from it, that's their truth, and I wouldn't argue with it. I didn't have Victor Hugo consciously in mind. I've certainly read all of Victor Hugo, so perhaps subconsciously, yes, you know.
But I mean, that idea of the relentless hunt,
yeah,
even when she's warned off, you know, and that's something that happens in this book. It's happened in other, certainly in The Border, where from time to time, the alphabet soup of our government that protects us might ask somebody to do something for them. And I don't think that that's fiction.
I don't think it is either.
Bad people can do good things.
Mm-hmm.
And good people can do bad things.
Absolutely.
So we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, she's Reggie, whose motivations are not pure. They're based on revenge, I think. Is told to lay off Danny, and yet.
Doesn't.
She pursues him with just a single-mindedness that's really pretty mythic.
Yeah. Well, Reggie's based on a goddess who had a relentless vendetta against Aeneas, and pursues it to the, you know, as far as she can possibly take it. You know, the other relentless pursuit in this book is by the prosecutor in Rhode Island, Marie, who is based on the Furies from Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy, which culminated in the first trial scene in Western literature, you know. And so the Furies, these three women, hunted down, you know, their convict until they got him and brought him back to trial.
And we're talking about Marie Bouchard, who
yes.
I found very, very interesting that first she is of French Canadian descent.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that she's a former nun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they called her Attila the Nun. So she was,
Attila the Nun,
interesting
yeah.
Here. So.
Yeah. She's turned into one of my favorite characters, you know, over the course of these three books. She was fun to write and interesting to write, and I hope interesting to read, you know.
She rang very well. All of your characters ring very true, and to me, she rang. You know, I could hear her. I could feel her moral compass moving and doing its best to find true north. The other thing I find in all of your books, and really a lot in City and Ruins, was the philosophical balance between free will and predestination,
mm-hmm.
or you know, which is sort of the core of the range of Christian religions, from Catholicism right through Calvinism.
Mm-hmm.
So a reader might ask, you know, why didn't Danny Ryan just walk away? And I, of course, have a theory, and thank you for saying that the readers are allowed to bring
I want to hear it. Yeah.
Their prejudices to, I recalled an interview with the showrunners of The Americans, about how they ended the show, and
great series.
Oh, it was a great series.
Great, great series. I've watched it twice. Yeah.
And Matthew Rhys and Kerry Russell have made it back to Russia, and one turns to the other, and I don't remember which one turned to whom, and said, "What do we do now?" And the answer was, "We'll adjust." And the showrunner said that the series at its core was always about a marriage. And that's how I felt about all three books, but especially City and Ruins. It was always about Danny's marriage to Teresa, you know, who had died of breast cancer in the first book, very early in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always about Danny's promise to her to take care of their son, Ian. Maybe
Yeah.
Others could have walked away, but Danny Ryan, as created in the mind of Don Winslow, could never walk away from that. So is that an accurate?
I think it is. I think it is. You know, again, it follows the life arc of Aeneas, whose wife disappears in the Iliad. Well, it's actually not in the Iliad. It's in the Aeneid. You know, we always think the Iliad tells the story of the Trojan Wars. It doesn't. It picks it up in the middle and it ends in the middle. And we find the ending of it in other books. But Danny is always has the memory of Teresa in his mind and in his heart. He very, very much loves his son. I think a lot of the choices that Danny makes, for good or for ill, and there are plenty of the latter, by the way, come from a tragic, fatal flaw that every tragic hero has to have. Danny's is loyalty. And, you know, whether it's loyalty to the memory of his late wife, loyalty to his son, I think the bad decisions come about from loyalty to his friends and to his tribe, if you will. That's, I think, for me anyway, Danny's biggest motivator.
We should talk about his tribe, and we should talk about the idea of this Rhode Island, which most people think of as sort of quaint and little and small and cute.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
This is like a concentrated offshoot of either Boston or New York. It depends who you talk to, you know, organized crime. And there's a fair amount, because there's a lot of places to bring things ashore. It was a very active place during Prohibition for the importation of liquor.
People still tell those stories, by the way. Now, I was standing in my driveway last summer in Rhode Island, talking with people who were talking about their great-grandparents and grandparents who were rum runners, who would bring the stuff in at Moonstone Beach, quite near us, and then up to a place that's still active, you know, in the woods, that used to be a speakeasy and now is, of course, a legitimate bar and restaurant. So all of those things are still within human memory.
But you've got, and you've also then got the idea of the intersection of the Italian mob and the Irish mob, both of which are strong. The Irish mob is, I believe, was a little bit stronger in Boston. And of course, the Italian mob
Yeah.
a little stronger in New York. But
That's
this is
right.
really where the two sort of, it's almost like a little tidal. It's almost like a riptide
Yeah.
of crossover. And that's where Danny gets himself into a bit of a pickle before he goes on the run and continues. It doesn't end. He's
Right.
still, even in the third book, he is having to talk to Pasco Ferry, who had been
Right.
boss in
Yeah. Apollo, yes.
Let me ask you a sort of a craft nerd question. Did you have big sheets of paper up where you put this person will be this goddess and this person represents that god?
Yeah, I had a list. I didn't have a big piece of paper, but I had a document, that kept track of who was who, because every character in the three books has an analogous character in the classics. You bring up, there's so much to talk about with what you said, in terms of Rhode Island. I mean, it's the state that has this redheaded stepchild kind of mentality being between Boston and New York. It's so funny where I live. If you go to a certain grocery store in the summer, you'll see people with Yankees caps. And if you go 4 miles north to a different grocery store, everyone has Red Sox caps. There's this definite cultural divide, it's kind of fascinating to me. And Rhode Island it's unique. It was born in an act of rebellion, by a guy who left the Puritans and established a state that was the first state in history to guarantee religious freedom. And it still has that sort of ornery, we're our own thing, yeah, we're really small, but we like it. And everyone knows everyone, which is why I set the book there, because to me, it was important that these now enemies were former friends who were intimately involved with each other.
They're involved and in many cases related either by blood or marriage. And it also you do bring a very good point, especially about the ball teams. And you bring it up that in the three books, Danny is a Red Sox fan, which at the time most of the action takes place is an exercise in extraordinary patience. Maybe
Yes.
we're getting into the Bible because maybe it's Jovian.
Jobian. It's certainly Catholic suffering, and I remember, I mean, when the Red Sox finally won the World Series, I was on my knees in front of the TV set in California with my mother's phone number in Rhode Island dialed, waiting to hit send. And when the last out came, I hit send and she was weeping on the phone,
Some of my Boston relatives were the same. They were, it was, the break, the curse of the Bambino.
That's right. That's right.
So,
Yeah.
and now it's not quite the same when they do well, but I will say that my sister-in-law who moved from New York to Boston then embraced the Red Sox like any, because there's nothing worse than a convert.
That's right. That's correct. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I threw out the first pitch at a Yankees game. And they gave me a jersey, and I was at my mother's house, and I hung it up in the closet, and she was very concerned. I came down the next morning, and she just looked at me and said, "You're not a Yankees fan, are you? You haven't gone over to Satanism, So.
You're better off changing your religion, I think. We touched on this and we said your characters, including Danny and Pasco and Marie and Jimmy and all of his gang. Jimmy is his pal who sees him through thick and thin. They include good people who do bad things and even a few bad people who do good things. And I'm thinking specifically of Pasco Ferry. So, is it challenging to work in that realm of moral ambiguity? I don't mean is it challenging to live in a world of moral ambiguity because we're still breathing. But do you find yourself sometimes disagreeing with the characters who live in your head about about their choices? Like, Danny, dude.
Danny, dude, don't do it. Like Cassandra does in book one, you know, which is Cassandra's role, right? Is the doomed prophetess that no one listens to. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But look, I can't, I'm not interested in moral issues when I'm writing a character. You know, what I'm trying to do is bring the reader into that character's world, to see the character's life through the character's eyes. And so I can't be objective. I can't, you know, lean back from the keyboard and make moral judgments, although I might have them. When I'm writing, when I'm actively writing, I have to be totally inside that character's head, and see the world the way he or she sees it, you know, and suspend whatever sort of moral judgments or even practical judgments, you know, that I might have.
Like many writers, I expect that you possibly have certain favorite characters or characters that you,
yeah, sure.
You like all of your characters, though. I do. I think, well, some of the bad guys, maybe not, but I think...
There's a few I despise. There's a couple in this book. But no, for the most part, I do like my characters, and I do have empathy toward them. And I think for the reasons that you've alluded to, listen, moral ambiguity is a great thing for a writer.
Well, certainty it does keep things gets, interesting.
Yeah, certainty gets boring, you know, I think. And so I like the moral ambiguities. And I think they're real. I think that's closer to real life. You know, on the subject of loyalty, for instance, it's one thing to write about a conflict between being loyal or disloyal. It's more interesting, though, I think, to write about conflicting loyalties. When you have to choose between two people or two ideas that you feel fiercely loyal about, and they're in conflict, that to me is interesting.
And also there are these miscommunications that especially happen in the third book. That you have that idea of the sliding doors principle of, you know, going through door A or door B. And in City and Ruins, there are things that, and I don't want to say anything, I don't want to spoil it because boy, is this a good book, where things might have gone completely differently if something hadn't happened.
Yeah. A turn of phrase, even one little incident that sends things spinning. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that most of the conflicts in the criminal world, or perhaps in the world in general, are about money and power, which effectively are the same thing. So sometimes I think that these little things that happen that seem quite personal and are often a cover, either consciously or subconsciously, for a conflict over money and power.
So I don't think it's a spoiler to say by the time we get to the third book, and I got to say, I loved how you ended City of Dreams, where he's just on this peyote mushroom trip that with that sort of sentence of anybody who's ever done a psychedelic, and I'm not saying I have, thinks that way. It's just it's just a stream of consciousness and so brilliant. And then the guy who he encounters decides to let him live. Once again, one of those sliding doors moments. I could kill you, but you know, why bother? But in this in this book, he is ascended. He is by any measure, power or money, a success. When you envisioned the three books, and I think I talked to you about the first book, did you see this arc, this entire arc, or no, you didn't?
I didn't. Listen, I saw it in very general terms, Nancy, because I knew I was going to follow Aeneas's arc. And I knew Aeneas therefore had to build an empire. But I had no idea what that empire could be. And I tried several times and failed at it. I'll bet I threw away 300 to 400 pages of this book before I hit on something that I hope worked. When I figured it out, it seemed so obvious, I felt really stupid. you know. But I wrestled with the question, where in America in the 1990s do you build an empire? Where could a guy like Danny, right, build an empire? And when it occurred to me that it was Las Vegas, I went, well, of course, if you have the money, you can build anything, right? You can follow any fantasy. And it's an open kind of town, you know? And once I hit on that, and once I hit on that the central conflict that precipitates the action in the book should be about a piece of real estate, then that really opened it all up for me and made it doable. But no, I was lost in the tall grass, which is why it took me 30 years to write this thing, because I couldn't figure it out.
Well, you did a couple of things in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few.
You had a few books in between. Books.
Yeah.
A few big books and some movies and all kinds of stuff. But
all kinds of, but I wanted a big change for Danny in the third book. Do you know what I mean? I wanted a radically different set of circumstances for him. And then I was hoping that the readership would go with me, would be willing to take that leap.
Well, the challenges, it's interesting because you mentioned power and money. The challenges in dealing with people and situations are different and yet not different.
Mm-hmm.
The scale is larger.
Mm-hmm.
But the interpersonal miscommunications and communications, I'm thinking of one, and it's not a spoiler, I'm thinking of one scene in the third book where Danny goes and confronts someone who is standing in his, what wants to stand in his way.
Mm-hmm.
And this person says to him, you know, he's a father. And Danny looks at this person and says, so am I.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that just draws this sort of through line that maybe all of us should think about. Most of us are parents. Most of us have children. That's a common thread.
Mm-hmm.
We want the best for them.
Yeah. I think that, you know, if I can be egotistical enough to judge my own book, I think that this is the most compassionate book I've written. And I think it's because maybe where I am in life, you know, while I was writing this book, I wrote a lot of this book during COVID. And during that time, my mother had passed away. And it was a situation where we couldn't go be with her because you couldn't travel. There was no funeral. You know, it was just like you got up one morning and, oh, you know, your mother died. I think it made me think a lot about parenthood, you know, from both sides. You know, I am a parent. And so I remember writing the scene that you're alluding to, you know, and thinking that there was a moment where those two people might have connected on that level, but didn't do it.
Right. And that's another one of those sliding doors and missed communications. And I have to say, I've said this to you before, but I cried at the end of this book. I cried at the end of The Border. I cried at the end of The Force.
I'm sorry.
No. I think, you know, when I read a lot of books, and most of them, it's sort of, you know, some of them I read with the idea of interviewing the writer. I went back and reread your first two books because I was so excited that I was going to be able to talk to you about this book that I wanted to be prepared, because you are a person that understands if the interview is prepared or not.
Sure. So yeah. I
didn't want to fall short.
Thank you.
And no, thank you. So, you know, that was to me a small scene and just so indicative of this story of missed opportunities, missed communication, just, you know, seeing a common thread within lives of opposing political viewpoints and not being able to pick it up.
To bridge it. Yeah. Yeah.
It really is a bridge too far. And which sort of brings me to, you know, the elephant in the room. And I remember your tweet announcing that City in Ruins. Oh, but wait, before I do that, I have a word nerd question, because I don't know if you know this. I am a word nerd.
Okay.
And you have City on Fire, City of Dreams, and City in Ruins, and you use a different two-letter preposition in each title. Is that intentional?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. I don't know what more to say about it, but yes, it was intentional.
Okay.
Yep.
Great and words now to the question. Elephant in the room.
Okay.
You know, I remember your tweet announcing that City in Ruins would be your last novel, and mm-hmm. to which I have a couple things to say. First of all, is say it ain't so, because you're just getting good at this. I'm glad you're laughing. And at the time of the announcement, you indicated that it would be your life's work to do your best to save us from ourselves and to speak truth to power, regardless of the consequences. And I know that you've been threatened. And I absolutely loved one of your responses, that you were 60 some years old and come and get me. I respect, but I mean, Don, please write another book.
Listen, I think I've said this before. We don't get to choose the era in which we're born. We like to think we have unlimited choices in life, and to a great extent we do, but they're not unlimited. And I live now in this era, in this time. If I were to write a novel about all of this, it would take me 2 to 3 years to write a decent book, another year to a year and a half in the publishing process. By that time, this fight would be over. I don't want to be writing the elegy on American democracy. And so it requires a different kind of writing. You know, it requires the Twitter and the, or I guess it's X now, or the videos, you know, that we do. That have reached over 300 million people, you know? That's, I believe, where my focus needs to be now. Because I
damn you and I thank you.
Okay, and you can do both at the same time. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of word nerd, that's pretty good.
I mean, believe me, I watched all your videos and I felt your... I felt your need to do this, and I commend it. It is too bad that the publishing process is so long and arduous, and writing a book for anyone who's never done it is the closest thing I can think of to torture. It's a divine torture, but a torture.
Yeah.
And yet the people who do write them just have to. And this seems to be what you're doing now, this direction you're going in with the videos and the communicating to everyone. And I actually find them, your videos are, they're so factual and they're so moving, and they're like mini movies.
Movie.
Nerd thing failed.
Yeah. No. But I think you're onto something here. Listen, Shane Salerno and I do the videos. He's a famous screenwriter. We're deliberately using cinematic techniques on these videos very carefully and very deliberately to have an effect, which I think that they have, you know, so you're not wrong.
Okay. Well, if you save democracy, or if you help save democracy.
Well, help. Yeah, I would play a minor role, but I think that we should be doing what we can do. I'm not a big name, you know, I'm not, I have a certain platform. It's not huge, but I just feel, look, I can take you to the exact spot where my great grandfather was killed fighting to end slavery. My dad was 18 years old on Guadalcanal. In some ways, I'm happy he didn't see January 6th. And I was taught very carefully as a kid by that guy that to whom much is given, much is expected. And this is, I think, what's expected of me.
Well, once again, I thank you for that. And should you assist in the saving of our democratic experiment, I'm hoping you'll think about another book.
Yeah, when these white supremacists talk about blood and soil, I can talk about blood and soil. But having said that, I also believe that the most recent immigrants have just as much right to claim this country as I do. You know,
that's who we are. I mean,
my ancestors came over on the Mayflower, but that means nothing. We've been here a long time. Fine, I owe a lot because of that. But on the other hand, so what? Do you know that the person who came here last week has the same rights to this country as I do? It's all over the first book of the Danny Ryan thing. No Irish need apply, no dogs are Irish, and then the Italians came slightly later to Providence and experienced the same sort of discrimination, a lot of it from the Irish. You know, it's the story of our country. It's the story of our culture.
It is my great hope that you help us save it. Save us from ourselves, please.
Well, we have to win this one.
And maybe, possibly, once you do, you might write another book and we'll get a chance to have another chat.
I'm old enough to say never say never.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you so much, Nancy. Always great talking with you.